You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
I'm here at whitecollarboxing.ie. I'm joined by Cathal O'Grady, European champion, Olympian, professional boxer, and White Collar Boxing Supremo. Cathal, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, there's a few other titles in there as well, Andy, but I'll get to them later on as well, so I will.
Is it the cow KO, or is that what they call it?
I'll tell you about the cow. No, that's a dark piece of my life, so it is.
Cathal, how'd you get into boxing?
I suppose we grew up on a farm in County Kildare, a dairy farmer's, so it'd be normally Gaelic football, hurling, that you would have chosen. We did all those. There was myself and my brother, but at the time Barry McGuigan was winning world titles, and that was back in 1985. A local boxing club opened up just a couple of miles down the road, and we joined up, and we never looked back. Got hooked on it, really.
And did you take to it naturally? Was it something that you enjoyed straight away?
Yeah, I remember the first night. The first night you went down there was sparring. First night in, and I got a bloody nose the first night. My nose used to bleed quite a bit. But so after that, it was sparring the whole way. It was probably not as much learning as there should have been, but it was fun. There was rounds every night, and there was always someone going home crying.
It was a tough education.
It was a tough education. And probably not, you learn more about fighting necessarily than the basics. So you had to go back and learn them at a later stage, which isn't the best way to learn boxing.
And do you remember your first fight?
I had a load of fights. I suppose I started boxing when I was 7 years of age, 6 years of age. So, I had all these fights. They were unofficial fights. You weren't meant to win or lose, but, you usually did win all the time anyway. But I remember when I was 10 years of age going to Wexford for a fight. And we got down to Wexford. Our club was Southmead. It was a great club. Seamus McDonough actually was from there, and it was a great club. We went down a little minibus to Wexford, and when we got down there, there was no fight. I had no fight, and I was absolutely devastated. But there was this kid who was 12 years old, and he was 10 and 12, there's a big age difference, and he was also 5 kilos heavier than me. And I said, look, I want to fight him. And the guy said, no, this guy is after winning the Wexfords, he's after winning the Leinsters, he's going into the Boy 2 All-Irelands, and he's a hopeful. He got Leinster Boxer of the Year. I says, I still want to fight him, He was there, I remember it to this day. I was there with me jeans, and they had this green detail, the pockets stitched in, no back pockets, and he had a pair of jeans with back pockets and all. He had one of these varsity tops. It was black with some letter. We'll say it's W for Wexford, and the white sleeves. And he had a girlfriend at 12, this blonde girlfriend with curly hair. Oh, she looked like she was just out of a Bourbia ad advertising milk or something like that. So anyway, they agreed.
You hated him straight away.
If the girlfriend wasn't one reason enough, the jacket and the jeans was two more reasons. So they agreed to fight, and his coach said, "We're going to stop this as soon as it gets out of hand at all, because this is ludicrous." And I was here just nodding my head, thinking, "Yeah, well, they'll stop it all right." So anyway, the bell rang for the first round, and I unleashed hell on this poor guy. And I know they rang the bell early after, in the first round, because I was hitting them with absolutely everything. I think it went around 20 or 30 seconds into the second round, and that was enough. I think that was that poor guy's boxing career over. I remember going back to my corner and kind of expecting the girl to be there with the jacket in her hand waiting for me, but, she wasn't,
Yeah.
I had to wait a couple of more years to get my first girlfriend,
Well, that's the thing. Like, sometimes with boxing and with sport, you think that victory or winning or being successful kind of we'll complete the circle, or we'll kind of, like you said, you think I thought the girl that everything was going to be great, but it doesn't really, does
no,
it?
You know, I didn't get. I actually bought a jacket like it around 20 years later, and I wore it once or twice. You know, it wasn't that jacket. So
you want a 12-year-old jacket?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want it, but yeah. I kind of knew then I was very strong, and I could punch a bit, and I was raw, and I wanted to win. And you know, I suppose in boxing, if you want to win and you can punch, that's going to take you, you know, a little bit of the way anyway.
Well, you went to the as a junior, you went to European Championships and gold medal. And me growing up as a kid, I'd always hear about Cathal O'Grady, European champion. He went to the European Championship, won gold medal. And like, just to put it into context for people, like winning a European gold medal is a lot of the times harder than winning a gold medal in the Worlds or a gold medal at the Olympics, because you're every country you face in Europe, they're well educated, very good boxers, and it's probably the hardest medal to win.
Well, it was difficult. And at the time, you know, there wasn't a landscape of everyone winning medals, you know, left, right, and center. You know,
it was that's why for me growing up, that was why it was like an outlier. Like, this guy actually won the medal. Like,
so it was, and it is still. You know, looking back, it was. The medal is probably somewhere in a drawer somewhere, and I won four fights. Actually, the person who won it the year before me, that same medal, was Klitschko, you know, at the same weight as well. Whatever happened to him after that? I don't know where it all went downhill for him after he won that. But, you know, so that's the level. And, you know, it was four fights, three of them inside the distance, and a points win over a tough German, you know, and it was very, and it kind of launched me onto, I was only just turned 18, and it launched me as a senior boxer, probably a little bit premature, but when, you know, I'd no place left to go, only senior at 17, 18 years
of
age.
Enough kind of thing, isn't it? Yeah. And I'm sure at that stage people were signaling you as a future professional, but were you intent on going to the Olympics then?
I was, you know, the Olympics was always something, you know, it was always, and it still is dangled as this huge big carrot, maybe wrongfully so, as, you know, the be all and end all of amateur boxing and professional boxing. But for me, it was something that I really wanted to go. I won that European Juniors in 95 and then entered the National Senior Championships in 1996, and I won it 2 days after my 19th birthday, the senior heavyweight title. I beat Paul Douglas, who'd gone to the quarterfinals in the Olympic Games before. So you know, what do you do if you're, you know, if you win it, you're ready to go. And then it was off to the Olympic qualifiers, and I scraped in and made it there, last man in.
Amazing.
But
what was that Olympics like? On the team, you would have had Francie Barrett. Who else was there?
Brian McGee, Damien Kelly. Yeah. So there was just four of us there. And I suppose it was an unusual time. We trained in Florida. I never sparred one amateur boxer before the Olympic Games at all. I sparred Uriah Grant, world cruiserweight champion. I sparred Lenkoff Johnson, world light heavyweight professional champion. And I sparred a big Jackson guy who was just after doing 8 rounds with Lennox Lewis as a professional heavyweight. You know, so you're battering at these guys. So it was in a gym in Miami, rough part of town, and it wasn't ideal preparation. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed sparring with those guys, you know, and I was having a good bit of success. So, you know, it wasn't the correct preparation, but it was my preparation, and I made the most of it.
And how long after the Olympics, or immediately after the Olympics, were you thinking about turning pro?
I suppose just getting back to the Olympics, you know, first. I was thinking about going pro before the Olympic Games. I had some offers, you know, some people came over to talk to me, you know, and I probably should have focused on what was in front of me at the time as a 19-year-old fighter, you know, not be thinking about, you know, the Olympic or anything past the Olympic Games. But
in terms of being in Atlanta and the whole experience of the Olympics and
The Olympics for me was, you know, was a mixed bag. So I remember the week leading up to the Olympic Games, it was, you know, the secret was out that Muhammad Ali, one of my all-time idols, was going to light the Olympic flame. And you could not get a ticket for love nor money because at the time he was struggling badly with his Parkinson's and, you know, they were questioning whether he was actually going to be able to hold the Olympic torch steady enough to light this Olympic flag. I knew he was because I knew he was just playing possum and toying with the audience as well. But I weighed in on the Friday morning for the Olympic Games and the draw was made that day, which had me fighting when the Olympic Games opened on a Sunday morning. Olympic ceremony was that night, so I missed, you know, I had that ticket to see Muhammad Ali, but I wasn't willing to sacrifice my first fight in the Olympic Games for staying up running around some Olympic stadium half the night. You know, I watched that from, you know, the Olympic Village, and I said, I'll be ready come Sunday morning.
I had the exact same thing in 2004, that the same thing. The open ceremony was the night, and I had to fight the next day.
Yeah.
And it kind of took away. I went to the closing ceremony, and it was only then that it hit me that I was at the Olympics. You know, yeah. Like, well, this is what it's about. This is the feel. Like, walking around and seeing the crowd and all the camaraderie and the friendliness and, I don't know, between the countries and... That's what it's all about, the Olympic spirit
about competing. Yeah, that's what it's all about. And realistically, you know, they need to have the opening ceremony at least 2 or 3 days clear of competition that everyone can go and let it be this great celebration of all the sports and all the countries in the world coming together. But we know that the Olympics isn't, you know, 100 years on. I was in the Centennial Olympic Games and the shit was getting darker and darker by the minute, so it was, you know.
Tell me about the boxing, the actual boxing at the Olympic Games.
So I suppose, you know, so Friday the draw is made. So I remember the weigh-in on Friday morning. I was boxing at 91 kilos. And
were you weighing 91 around that
weighing
time?
Weighing bang on 91, you know, on the button. I remember getting on the scales, and Felix Yvonne was there beside me, and he weighed exactly the same, you know, the same way. Now, he was 6 inches taller, but no, he hadn't got a good pair of GAA legs on him, though. You know, they were skinny old yokes. He'd be pushed off the ball if he was in full forward, so he would. But I drew a New Zealander, Garrett De Silvia, and that was a really good draw. You know, the guy could fight a little bit. He made it to the Olympic Games, but he was someone that I could definitely beat. And I was, so Sunday morning, 12 o'clock, got into the ring. I'm out of the ring, you know, getting dressed again by 10 past 12. I was up 7-2, and it all just went horribly wrong afterwards. And I remember just absolute devastation. Like, there were people still arriving to the Olympic ceremony or to the Olympic Village to compete in the games, and I'm out. And I remember going to, you know, this great food emporium that they've all the foods from every nation in the world. And I went over to the McDonald's, and I don't even like McDonald's. And I went and I said, give me a couple of, you know, Big Macs or some shit like that. And I sat down and ate them. And that was a real safe haven for losers. Yeah. You know, if you were sitting down eating McDonald's on the first day of the Olympic Games, things didn't go too well for you at the Olympic Games. So it didn't. So it was... You know, and I suppose...
Do you think you would have, if you were drawn against a more respected boxer, you would have had a different outcome? Do you think, did you underestimate the New Zealand?
I didn't underestimate him. I got caught and I got beaten, you know, so that's... I actually have the video of the fight. A friend of mine works in RTE, and I asked her, will you get me the video of the fight? And she handed me a VHS, because I never saw it, you know, so I said, and you know what? I put that VHS in a drawer and I never watched it. And I might be missing out on some overwhelming cathartic experience, you know, if I pull it out and stick it into a VHS player and watch the 100 seconds or whatever length that it lasted. But you know what? I'm willing to take that chance and go on the way I am and forget about it. So I am, you know.
Well, it's there if you ever get the urge, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. If ever things get really bad and I need to feel worse about myself, it's always there. So it is.
But you never know. You might have a different perspective. You weren't doing so bad, you know.
I know I was, you know, look, it's there, I suppose there's a learning experience if you're still fighting, you know what I mean? But I'm not fighting anymore. Yeah. And now, looking back at the Olympic Games, I'm proud to have got there at 19 years of age. Mm. Disappointed that I didn't do that well, but still, you know, I've still a couple of Olympic tracksuits in a cupboard somewhere. Yeah. And they're awful looking yokes.
You never lose a title, you know.
You know, so it is. I don't, you know. It's, you know, I'm happy that I was there. Mm. Same as yourself, Andy. You were there, and you were beaten on a countback. Mm. You know, it promised so much. You know, but you know what? You draw a line under it, and you move on.
Exactly. In a lot of ways, it's built up to be the pinnacle and this great circus. And when you get there, you realize it's just like any other competition. And that in some ways, you can build it up to be more than it is.
Yeah, it is. Now, I suppose it's the 4 year. It only comes around four years. And if you mess it up, you only really get one chance, you know. And I think, you know, even though, you know, the lads will talk about your likelihood of success is far greater in your second Olympic cycle than your first. But, you know, those 4 years in between, and you mightn't even qualify with the way qualification has gone. And who knows, we mightn't even have boxing in the Olympic Games. Like, it's 2 years away, and we haven't even sorted that out. So, you know, the whole Olympics and boxing, you know, isn't in a really pretty, it's in a pretty bad place at the moment.
So how long at the Olympics was it that you turned professional?
I turned professional in 97. So Olympics was over, you know, August 97, or August 96, I turned pro in 97, in September 97. Mm. And I'd gone over and trained with Eddie Futch for a while and Tel Torrance over in Las Vegas, and Wayne McCullough was there at the time, who is one of my favourite fighters, and he's an incredible individual. He's, you know, he's just a lovely guy, and he really looked out for me. I remember being over there. What I noticed, I was sparring over there, and I was sparring some heavyweight, and this guy was trying to take my head off, you know. And I remember at the time, Eddie Futch was in the corner, so this big heavyweight was coming. He'd 5-0 as a pro. I turned him in the corner, you know, hit him two or three shots, and like dropped him. He was out, and I went over and I apologized. I says, "Look, Eddie," I says, "Sorry about that, but he was acting the maggot there, you know. It was me or him, and I was a good bit lighter than him, you know." And he says, "Don't ever apologise. That's your job." Yeah. And I remember getting in so much trouble in Dublin for knocking lads out sparring, and in England, no one liked it. But over there, like, he says, "That's your job."
Was there a story where you knocked out a cow or a horse? Oh. It is. So.
But just, you know, this, you know. We were growing up on the farm. We were dairy farmers, so we were milking the cows anyway. So I was in milking the cows, and there was this one cow, and she used to always kick the arms. She'd kick you all over the place, you know. And I was, you know, I didn't want to be in there. I had to go somewhere else, and she kicked me, and was really sore. And I'd been reading Roberto Duran's book where he knocked out a horse. So I said, "It can't be too bad if I hit this cow a box." And I was a southpaw like yourself. So I remember hitting the cow a straight left hand into the body. And down into a body shot, because I couldn't get near her head because I was down lower in the milking parlour. And she went down, dropped her on all fours. She was lying there in the milking parlour, wouldn't move. And I just felt really, really, really bad. So it's
going to get a lot of
A lot of stick. But yeah. I felt, you know, I had a
protection moment.
But you know, she kicked me first. Now you have to remember this was self defense. But she was lying there, and I said, I felt really bad. I said, "What a bully! You're a horrible individual." And eventually, she got onto her feet, and I let her out. And I couldn't stop thinking about her. I says, you know. And I woke up the next morning, And my father's in bad humour. And he says, there's a cow dead up the field. I says, oh, no. I says, not only did I drop her, she's dead. You know, there must be some internal bleeding. And I was going to tell him, you know, but I decided not to, because the cow then, this is back in 93, 94. This cow was probably worth around 1,200 pounds, you know. Like, this is a valuable piece of cow, you know. So I said, I'll say nothing. But anyway, so we had to go and get the cow. So we go up, and it's some other cow that's after dying. It isn't the cow that I ate at all. So it was, so, you know, I was, because I had contemplating going to be a vegan and everything that night, you know. This was after hitting the cow, I felt so bad. I said, I'm not going to eat meat or drink milk or anything like that. And this was when it wasn't even cool to be a vegan, back in 93. No one even knew what one was. But but it was another cow, so I'd say it was some sort of acute post-traumatic stress disorder, witnessing me hit the other cow, you know, to trigger the cardiac arrest or something like that. But no, you know, that, it was, you know, it was definitely, you know, Roberto Duran must have felt like shit after knocking out that horse as well.
I doubt he lost any sleep.
No, definitely not.
Tell me this, so as a pro, you trained with some of the best trainers in the game at that stage. Kevin Rooney, you mentioned Eddie Futch, a bit with Freddie Roach.
Yeah.
What was it like working with those guys?
It was great, you know, but I probably didn't get, the greatest trainer in the world is someone that you gel with, and you know, and you had that experience. You were lucky enough to have the greatest trainer in the world, and for him to gel with you.
And you trained with Emmanuel Stewart for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I trained with Emmanuel. I thought Emmanuel was just a phenomenal trainer. But it's someone that understands you and can watch your development and watch your mistakes, and you know, and try and build a career, you know, from and work on your strengths. So I finished my career with 18 professional fights, 16 wins, 2 losses. I think 14 of them were inside the distance of the wins as well, you know.
And just about how the end of your career came about, you failed a brain scan.
It was a routine MRA, you know, so it was a new requirement of the British Boxing Board of Control to have this MRA, which looks more at the vascular anatomy, looks at the blood supply to and from the brain, whereas the MRI looks at, you know, it's more, you know, the soft tissue. So it was found that I had I was missing a major blood vessel, my left vertebral artery. So they were worried if you suffered a severe rotational injury after a shot, that that the blood supply, you know, to your posterior lobe might be compensated, and that would be, you know, be a stroke or something like that. So that was it.
Always there, or something that developed?
It was something that was always there. They think, you know, they think it was a congenital thing. Well, it could have developed, but you know, yeah. The other one, the right one that I had was a good big fat one supplying me with plenty of blood, but and that's fine. There could be loads of people going around like this on day to day, but when you're at an at-risk game like boxing, where you know these things are put on the line, you know, they said no way.
How old were you at that stage?
I was just turned 24, so I think I had my last fight when I was 23. I was just turned 24, which was very young, you know. Especially I was a cruiserweight then, you know, so only just maturing, and it's a hard one to take, because I started boxing, as I said, at 6, so 24, so your whole identity is, you know, wrapped up in being this boxer, being this fighter, and then all of a sudden, with a stroke of a pen, your license is gone. So, you know, people say, oh, you're the boxer, and I'm actually not anymore, I'm the ex-boxer, and I suppose you struggled with that, and then you struggle with you wrestle with it for a good while, you know, especially when you're 24 and you're kind of in your prime, and you turn on Sky Sports and some bum that you dropped in the gym is making a lot of money. You know, that, you know, it does hurt, you know, a little bit, but then you put things in perspective. You know, there is a chance that something awful could have happened, that you could have been left like these guys weren't telling you this to, you know, they weren't taking your boxing license away just to be assholes. They were, you know, doing it for your best interest, you know. And I had,
how long did it take to, I know you would have took a while to come to that realization that
it did take, you know. And then, you know, especially until everyone that I ever bet was gone. I know it was, you know, I suppose it took a while, but, you know, outside of boxing, you know, I had a beautiful wife. Well, she wasn't my wife till a little bit after, you know. I've now 4 kids, you know, so you can't, you know,
looking back, I suppose, it is. I'm sure it was very
hard, it was difficult, and the promise of riches beyond your wildest dream and to make a lot of money, and that was, you know, you were left, you know, without a career, you know, without an income source, without a livelihood, a couple of shitty stories that, you know, that you can peddle for, you know, getting, you know, for a few years. But no, that's, you know, that's what you're left with. But that's... Mm.
So that's what did you do? What did you find yourself doing? Did you go back to the farm? Did you...
I went back. The father threw me out. I know.
He found out about the cow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she was still waiting there to kick me. And would you believe it? Any time I ever milked a cow, she would never give me a drop of milk. You know, the trust was gone between me and her. So she'd come in and it'd be like she just turned the other way, and not one milliliter of milk would she give me. But anyway, getting back to it, I suppose I still love boxing. Mm. So I said, okay, I didn't, you know, have a university degree, or I didn't, you know, have this, but I did actually go and work construction for a while with the guys, and I remember a funny story. So the lads called to my house, and you know, I suppose your friends, I had, you know, a couple of great friends, and you know, they were not worried. You know, they were just saying, you know, he needs a lift. So I remember the guys, Michael McGuire is the guy. This guy is he's a card. He called to my house, and he says, "Come on, I have a job for you in the local hotel." He says, you know. He says, it's 120 quid a day, which was a good, you know, this was back in 2001, which was a lot of money. And I thought they were doing some dry lining or something simple enough. So anyway, we walked in the door of the hotel anyway, and he says, if anyone asks you, you're a finished carpenter. I says, no, Michael, you're not doing this to me, you know. So he says, just stay with me, you'll be fine, you know. And he wasn't even the carpenter, but he was a good bluffer. So anyway, I walk in the door. I didn't really care. I was just laughing. And I was still, like, fit and strong from boxing. And it was in the middle of the summer. I had a short-sleeve shirt on. And this guy separated us. And, you know, he wanted Michael to do some job. And he asked me to do another job. And I had no tools or anything. And he says, come over here, you. And I just looking at him. And he says, I want you to hang a few doors. You know, he says, they're the big heavy fire doors. How would you be with that? I says, 100%, no problem. I'll hang your fire doors. All right, that's no problem. And so I walked. I had no tools. So I actually robbed, there was an electrician there, robbed some of his tools just to have something in my hand. And like, he's looking at the tools. And he goes over to me and he says, would you have hung many doors, you know, before? I says, well, if I get this one up, it'll be me first. But, you know, and then we had he found, you know, in fairness to them, they found jobs suitable for my skill set, which probably revolved around driving a dumper or making tea or something like that for a while. But I enjoyed the banter that, you know, with the lads, and it was great. The hotel went bust. The whole building went bust a couple of weeks later, though. So maybe I'm some partly responsible for that as well, by not getting those doors up.
But I guess when I met you, you came. It was at the start of the High Performance. That was the first time I met you. You would have only been around 26 then, was it? So it wasn't that long.
I was young, and I was probably too young to be a coach, even though I had so much to give, you know. And Gary Keegan interviewed me, and he wanted some of the passion. I was at the Olympic Games. I had a major medal at a at an amateur tournament, and there wasn't too many of them around then. It's not like now, everyone wins, you know. So he brought me in, and I worked as a high performance coach for two and a half years with Gary and with Billy and with Zor, and it's a time I thoroughly enjoyed, but I also learned that I didn't want to be a high performance coach. You know, maybe I was selfish. I didn't want to go around the world chasing someone else's dream, because I suppose I never got a chance to, you know, fully chase my own. You know, maybe if I went into it a little bit later, but it was great crack. And, you know, this is where I met yourself, Andy, and you know, that time in Finland.
Yeah, tell us about it. You were assigned as the only coach.
Yeah, the only coach.
You're only, how old are you, 26 yourself?
26, and they give me...
Those lads on the team probably older than you.
I think, you know, there was similar age, and they give me Andy Lee, who isn't too bad, to give me James Moore, you know, James, you know, but to give me Donovan and Sheehan as well, two of the biggest messers, you know, the two greatest lads.
Eric and Roy
over there. And this was just a training camp, so there was no fight, so it was just a kind of a bit of a blowout. And so they had to spar the Finnish and Norwegian team every day, who were rubbish. So you did it, you know, no disrespect, but you guys were a hell of a lot better. But I remember lying there, I was lying in the bed, and the Finnish coach, who was a guy called Esa, a true gentleman. The boys actually, you know, robbed him blind playing cards every night as well. But he knocks on my door, and I remember knocking on the door, and he comes in, peeps in, he says, "How are you?" I says, "Good." He says, "The lifeboat is missing." And I said, because we're in a lake district, you know, up, you know, and it was on like a lake. And I said, "Yeah, like, so what? What's the problem?" "So are Donovan and Sheehan." Oh, I said, "Okay, I see why you're coming to me." Donovan and Sheehan sold the lifeboat. That's what happened, isn't it? And so anyway, I go out here on this lake. It's freezing, minus something, are Donovan and Sheehan. Donovan has a snow shovel, and he's paddling with that, and Sheehan has a broken oar, and the two boys. This is a little narrow thing to go extremely fast, but they weren't coming in, so... I think we had some good plan. The only way to get them in was to go after
I
them
think
ourselves.
We really just wanted to get on the lake, didn't we?
But I remember there was myself and yourself and James Moore as well. But I think he just got me in the water anyway. So we nearly needed that lifeboat. Yeah. It was good fun.
Yeah,
so it was.
And good times.
And I suppose. You've got your world titles, you've got so many titles, but, you know, you look back at days like that, you know, trying to chase after Donovan and Sheehan in a lifeboat, and you laugh and you say, like, these are the memories, you know, that, you know, that of the good old days, aren't they, you know?
Yeah. And moving away from that, you were the first person, I know White Collar Boxing was big for a long time, still is, and was a real buzz, but you were the first person to ever bring White Collar Boxing to Ireland.
Yeah, it was. So when I finished as a high performance coach, I had this idea of bringing White Collar Boxing to Ireland, and people thought I was mad initially. So that's 13 years ago, 2005. And even though you're training people who, you know, who've no boxing experience, you know, who are never going to be, you know, any good per se, like they're never going to box in national championships, or they're never going to box at Olympic Games or anything like that. But I really, really enjoyed it, and I met so many amazing people, because everyone is fighting some sort of fight in their life, you know, be it overcoming whatever, you know, and for them to come in and just come into our boxing gym, this one here we have going now down in Harold's Cross, and to just to forget about what's going on in their life, you know, or in their workplace, and throw off the trappings of bureaucratic life, and just go and hit a punch bag for or climb into a ring and spar, or do the pads, or do some of the technical work, or and have a good old workout, you know, because, you know, the exercise is, you know, exercise is so underrated for everything, for mental health, for physical health, for everything. And that's, it's just another form of exercise. And the amount of people we have, and we've had the best shows, we put on some big events in the Mansion House, in New York, in Belfast, in the Europa Hotel, and they've been absolutely amazing. And I have guys that are here, to come, they're here the last couple of years. There's one guy who comes here and I says, did you know that you started boxing before Anthony Joshua? I says, and look at how bad you are still, But he just laughs at it because, it's he's actually here with me longer than Anthony Joshua is boxing. You don't have to be a champion, do you? There's something here for everyone, so there is.
Yeah. And in terms of yourself and on a personal level, something that you've overcome recently, in 2016 you were diagnosed with cancer. What was that like for you as being the man that you are, big, strong,
I suppose, I remember at the time, it was, what I said was, in boxing, the punch that you don't see coming is the one that does all the damage. And you know that, Khabarov didn't see that one, coming, or, and just out of the blue, I was at the dentist and she found a lump in my mouth and she sent me to the dental hospital for, for them to have further. I thought absolutely nothing of it. And so I went in there one Monday morning and there was a consultant from St. James's waiting there, and he says, look, you've got, that lump, they'd done a biopsy on it a couple of days earlier. And I didn't even know, biopsy is kind of cancerous, but you should be kind of thinking. But I didn't think of anything. And I walked in there and I did, I got, a big bang out of the blue. So it is, initially it's a huge shock. And initially your mind, Emmanuel, or Customato, the great trainer, he says your mind is not your friend. And when you're diagnosed with cancer initially, your mind isn't your friend because it starts running away saying, and every lump that you ever had and, it could spread here or could spread there or I'm dead or, all these things, went through your head until you're dealing with facts, it's best to deal with facts and it's best to deal with your facts as well, and my facts were, you have a salivary gland cancer, it's curable, and what you're going to need is you're going to need surgery, to cut out the lump. Mine was in the roof of my mouth, my palate. So I had to have what's called a palatectomy and a maxillectomy. So they had to take some of my maxilla here and some of the palate, my soft palate and hard palate and the roof of my mouth, cut it out. And then they send what to cut out for pathology to see, if there's any residual cells, in the outer area, which there was, so it had spread into, it's local bone and perineural invasion, it's called. So just locally it had spread a bit. So then the next stage of treatment was radiotherapy, and that was in St. Luke's Hospital. But I remember walking in the door of St. Luke's Hospital and that was when it hit home to me that, and I suppose it closed the book on my boxing career as well. I walked in the door and I remember going in the first time, because everyone in St. Luke's Hospital is in there because of cancer. It's a cancer hospital. So, they're either recovering from it, they're getting tested for it, they're getting treatment for it. So I remember walking in the door and, seeing a couple of kids with, with the hair gone, little bandanas, and I, here's this big, brute of a boxer, and he's afraid. He's, I'm petrified, and I don't want to make eye contact. I'm looking down, at the floor, not wanting to look at them. And then I remember sitting down in the waiting room, and then thinking, do you know what? These are my people. you know, now because I'm going through, you know, a cancer treatment. And you know what? You want to see fighters, you go to St. Luke's Hospital and you see that four-year-old kid that's playing, you know, and who's fighting all sorts of adversity. You see his mum and his dad who's travelling up and down, or you see, you know, you see the old man who's like 90 years of age and is still, you know, he still feels like he's got a lot more to give in life, that he isn't just giving up. He's fighting on. So I'm, you know, so I had 33 visits there, 33 sessions. That's how long my radiotherapy lasted. So what they do is, you know, they kind of burn away, you know, the cancer cells, you know. And so, like, it was, you know, it's tough going.
But it was something that you kind of, you went through on your own, because it wasn't until even you were cured that you were telling people about, or that it happened. It wasn't something that you, you know, you had to keep it yourself, or that you wanted to, or
just, you know, like, it's not something, you know, you go around saying. But there was a, they asked me in the dental hospital to do a kind of a mouth cancer, help out with mouth cancer awareness there, you know, because a lot of times people, your mouth is someplace that falls in between a dentist and a doctor to look at, you know, so people should, you know, go to the dentist yearly or every second year, and, you know, or the doctor, and just get there's an awful lot of tissue in there, just get it checked. And if there's, you know, if there's anything that's bothering you, and like, prevention is so much better than cure in this area. So Denise McCarthy, who's the head of the mouth cancer awareness in Ireland, she says, will you help us out with mouth cancer awareness day? Will you do a bit of a talk, and will we share your story? And you know, if it was going to help someone, you know, if my story, however, you know, boring or whatever it was going to make someone go and get a lump or something, investigate it. So that's, you know, so we done that. And I really, you know, and then when I went and done that, I felt like, okay, I can't let anyone down here, you know. So, it was something I was glad that I done, you know. I was really glad. Cancer is horrible. It's not, you know, it's not nice. But there are some lessons to be learned as well. I suppose I'm a father of four kids and I'm a husband. I probably got a lot closer. You know, my wife and kids were very good. You know, my wife is a nurse, you know, and very supportive. And it's all I have to do is turn up and do the treatment, you know, and get up the next day. You know, it's the people who are, you know, the partners or kids, they're the ones that, you know, have the more difficult time. You know, I just turned up and went and done it, and then crossed that one off the list. Okay, I have to go again tomorrow and the next day. But you know, so it is, you know, so it can bring people closer together, and that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah,
in the end, even like, something good came out of bad.
Yeah, you know, you have to pull positives from these things, you know, and I suppose that was the positives. And do you know what, and going back to that struggle that I had back when I was 24 years of age, when people asked me, Cathal O'Grady, are you the fighter? And I didn't know or not. I my face went blank because I didn't have the answer to that question or not, but I do now, because I got it in St. Luke's Hospital, and I am a fighter, and so are every one of those kids who walk in the door, and anyone, you know, who battles, you know, the disease in whatever form they have it, you know. So I'm still a fighter, 42 years of age.
Still going strong.
Still a fighter.
Still probably knock a few fellas out and a few cows.
Yeah. I haven't hit a cow since.
So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.